In this week's program, the role of emotions in politics. In his book, The Political Brain, Drew Weston, a political psychologist, claims that the American Democratic Party has got it badly wrong by concentrating on facts and figures. You sway the electorate, he suggests, not by using good arguments, but by eliciting the right feelings. Weston's indictment of the Democrats in that score is powerfully undermined by the example of Bill Clinton, one of the great emotional connectors of modern times. With me, Alison O'Connor, who's a columnist and broadcaster, Shane O'Mara, Professor of Experimental Brain Research at Trinity College Dublin, and Terry Prone, Chairman of the Communications Clinic. Alison, what did you make of the book?
I think that Drew Weston writes very well. I think particularly given that he is writing about an area outside his own area of expertise, he is clearly a very bright guy. But it's not enough to be a very bright guy if you want to write a book with such a volume of information and that you're trying to make a very strong point. And I think he does that excellently. And I can see why, you know, looking from what I've read about it and even looking at the blurbs, that many in the Democratic Party appear to have taken it to their hearts.
You mean offended by it or taking him up on it?
Yeah. I think that in some ways it's incredibly detailed and, you know, intelligently argued. And he, you know, he backs it up with research and goes through the history of psychoanalysis, all of that. In other ways, I found it sort of oversimplistic, thinking if it were that easy,
Terry, what did you think of it? Yeah.
Well, when it came out in hardback, I was so fascinated that I actually contacted the man. And I subsequently brought him to Ireland to talk to some people that I was working with. Because what he has done is to provide or refer to some scientific backup for principles that anybody who was a really great political speaker, communicator up to now knew instinctively that, for example, emotion helps you make the decision. Reason gives you the later rationalization of the decision, that you have to be sufficiently interesting for people to become invested in what you're saying before you hit them with a whole load of policy statements. And even at the simplest level, he provides evidence to suggest something that in my own business we have always held to, which is that the single most valid and most effective means of communication, not just in modern times, not just in historic times, but in prehistoric times, is the anecdote, the narrative, the Norse sagas, the Celtic legends. We tell each other stories in order to understand the world that's around us at the time that we live. And he makes the point, because it has to be said that the book is extraordinarily skewed towards how the Republicans in America behave communicatively as opposed to how the Democrats behave. But it's nonetheless a much wider application, this one. He would maintain that the Democrats tend to go into elections, or have tended with notable exceptions, with a kind of a laundry list of worthy issues on which they want to lay out policy stances. Whereas he says the people who actually attract the public attention, put stuff into the public mind that the public mind remembers and therefore motivates the public mind to act upon at the voting booth, that they have a much greater grasp of the function of anecdote. Now, he does give a wonderful example of that, where he's talking about the famous presidential debate, which was in a kind of a town hall setting between George Bush Sr. and a very young Bill Clinton. And somebody in the audience asks about the current dreadful economic situation and what it's like, how they experience it. And George Bush has clearly been coached, but the coaching really has been too superficial. And he talks about having gone to a local black church. The problem is that he talks about what he read on the notice board of the black church rather than what the real people told him.
I don't want to into this in more detail lately. Just at this point, just want to get your overall reaction. I get the impression you really like the book.
I was fascinated by the book. Yeah, it's extremely enjoyable, even if you aren't in my business.
Yeah, Shane O'Mara, what did you think of it?
So I found it a very curious book, I have to say. I went reading it with one set of expectations, which was that there would be much more brain in it than there actually is, and there isn't. I think what he's tried to do here is provide a veneer of science that's kind of interesting, but to specialists is not entirely convincing. I think where the brain is discussed in this book, you should think of it as metaphor rather than substance. And the reason for that is very simple. This book was written or published in 2007, so it would have been written over the period coming up to 2007. So it's quite out of date. The massive explosion in social neuroscience that has happened since this time is completely absent in this book. I think the core idea is a very old one, but I think it needs restating time and time again. We're not simply reasoning creatures. To listen to economists, we are.
Yes, but on that point, I felt slightly bludgeoned, Alison, by the book, in the sense that, you know, you read it and you say, right, we're not neither totally one or the other. We're both, in a way, and that the strategists need to appeal to both sides of it.
I like that word, bludgeoned, Andy, because that I didn't think of it, but that's a little bit of how I felt as well, in that I felt that it could have been a shorter book. He's making the same point in many
different
ways.
How about that,
Terry?
Do you think it could have been shorter? Or did you find it on
the long
side?
It depends on your level of involvement and what you want to be persuaded of. Because why I found it so fascinating was that it was almost a 40-year answer to a problem that I've had over four decades, which is that if you say to people who are policy wonks, who are party activists in this country, no, we don't start with policy, we start with connection. We start with emotional connection. And they immediately assume, A, you're wrong, but B, that you are fighting against reason and against inclusion of policy. And what you're saying is much more subtle than that. You're saying, oh no, we must get policy in, but in a form that people on one hearing, because that's how they're going to hear it from a television programme, for example, will get it and remember it and serve as verbal ambassadors for it in future. And so I found the level of exemplification
But at this point, though, Terry, about the sense of, you know, I'm reading enough, listen, you know, fine, you make your point about the neglect of the emotional side, but don't we really need both? Does he stress that enough? Need to appeal to both sides of our nature, like
Sir Alison is. Part of his, I mean, I think, as I said earlier, he's an excellent communicator, very bright guy. I think he fell very much in love with his idea. And felt the need to overshare it. Now, and that's not to take from the fact I think this book is a very valuable book, A, to the Democrats, but even to politicians here in Ireland. But one of the things that kept coming up for me when I was relating it back to the situation here, I was thinking, how would he handle the situation that we had here with the 2007 election, where it was quite clear that our economy was taking a nosedive, and that we were in trouble, and that Fianna Fáil had brought us into a great deal of trouble. But yet emotionally, and in many other ways, the electorate were tied to Bertie Ahern. They associated and identified him with success, and the opposition couldn't do right for doing wrong. So how you'd tie in his theories, I mean, you know, there isn't a lot of logic in that, yet that's the way that election went.
The title of the book, Shane, The Political Brain, I take it that was for selling purposes. Anything with brain in it.
Is very sexy at the moment. Yeah. And we are in the middle of a revolution of understanding how our brain works. And there's a book that has just recently come out by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics not so long ago, called Thinking Fast and Slow. And that book is actually an interesting counterpart to put beside this book, because Kahneman makes the key point in that book that if you look at how our brains are organized, how we interact with the world, we actually have two different systems. One is our system for conscious deliberation. We think about things. As Terry has already said, we engage in story editing. We impose narrative on things, and we try and make sense of the complexity of the world. But the other is a system of kind of automatic responding. And we think that our conscious deliberation has primacy. After all, our conscious experience is what we are. But it's very little of what the brain is. And this is a key point, actually, when I'm teaching students as well, to try and get across that while our consciousness is all that we are, what our brain has to do is support our consciousness, but it also has to support breathing, respiration, and whole gamut
of
other
functions. It's got a lot of work to do.
It's got pain perception. It's got to allow you to understand what I'm saying to you in real time and formulate a question quickly. And that's not an easy thing for a brain to do.
Haven't we all had that experience in relation to politics, particularly at election time or in a referendum campaign or something, where you feel your own illogicality? And you try and reason it out
but
yourself.
But there's a limit, isn't there? If you say, you know, I like this guy, I like this woman on the platform, but there's a limit to how far you'll go, Terry, if you really don't like what they're saying, their policies.
Well, the emerging argument, not just from Weston, but from other writers as well, is that we have no idea the level at which genetics kicks in. That, for example, there are a number of genes that relate closely to things like fearfulness and so forth, and they are more frequently found in people who would be on the Republican side of the argument rather than the Democrat. I will not use the analogy in Ireland. And that is one of the things that Weston is interesting on, because he recruited a number of people who were very passionately and convincedly Republican, and a parallel group who were very passionately and convincedly Democrat. And he showed them slides with quotations from George Bush or whoever. And what emerged was that something that all of us in this business have known instinctively all the time, which is that if you are born, raised, bred, generational Fianna Fáil, if a quotation goes up there that is against Fianna Fáil, that rubbishes some central tenet of Fianna Fáil, you immediately, your mind goes into overdrive to find a way to disallow that.
Yeah, we're all tribalists at heart. There are many of us, aren't
but
you?
There's, yeah, sorry, the, I'm just Alison, thinking of an anecdote actually relating to that. I have an aunt who is just that seed breed of generation Fianna Fáil. And I remember after that election, when all of the stuff was going on with the Tribunal and Bertie Ahern and all this stuff was coming out about his finances, and she was staying with us and we were teasing her about it all. And, you know, where did her loyalty stand now? And she said, I remember she said, ah, he's just a little bit shady. And sure, what's the harm in that? You know, I mean, how do you logic for that?
One thing, it's not just the Democrats who are reading this. I saw David Miliband at a recent Labour Party conference and he said, I want to tell you who I am and what I stand for.
Kiss of death. Huh? Kiss of death. The minute any politician, and I mean, Romney did it also, you want to know more about me? Well, actually, sorry, honey, no, we don't. If we don't have a sense of you that we identify with, telling us more about your autobiography will not work at all. And that's one of the things that Weston is quite interesting about, in that sometimes he goes way back, beyond the current politicians. And he points to the guys who knew how to do it before the science was there to support.
A lot of time for Southerners on that score. He seems to think that,
that they have much more emotional availability.
Were the great connectors,
good thing,
you know,
to see.
The Southerners. One thing I find, to me, it's the most, certainly one of the most interesting questions about American politics, and Tom Frank wrote a book about it, and that is why Americans vote against their own economic interests. This is, you know, on the face of it, if you look at, say, Irish politics, neither party is clearly a party for the rich, is it? Alison, what do you think of that? You can't, there's no clear ideological divide in Irish politics.
No, and I suppose that's what, when you're writing about American politics, that's what makes it far easier in that way. It's a far more, I mean, that's long been said about Irish politics, and particularly now, you can say, with the absence of the Progressive Democrats in terms of their position more on the right, that it's everything is, I mean, in reality, if you look at this current government, they came into office saying that they were going to be very different, and albeit that, you know, the IMF is here. But that if you were to pick up anybody's, we'd say, between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and their election manifestos,
but what I'm
and
saying
read
is
them blind.
You wouldn't say about any party here, would you?
No, it's very different.
You wouldn't say that's the party that's angling, looking out for the well-off. You wouldn't, would you?
Well, people would have said it about the PDs, but I don't think...
Well, neither of the two mainstream parties. Yeah, Shane O'Mara, your thoughts on that?
So I guess what I would say in this is that we have a problem in this country, which is we have a very small population. You know, we have 4.5 million people, which is about the size of the state of Iowa. And we don't have the ideological divides that will naturally occur in a country of 330 million people. And that's, I think, a key point in terms of we can't map Ireland easily onto the US because we're talking a 90-fold difference in terms of population.
But isn't there a personality? I mean, I agree that there's a population thing, but it's intriguing reading this book about how the nature of the polarisation, and particularly in relation to the Republicans, as we know, that they're so extreme in their positions. There are no shades of grey. And he is saying that's what appeals to people. It appeals to them emotionally. There is no doubt. But I think that it's the Irish electorate, you know, are different. They think of things differently. They often don't take, if you see, particularly even on any on extreme right positions, they don't necessarily take to that. We haven't seen much evidence of that in recent times
question
in Ireland.
As the extent to which strategists have to bring emotions into play. If you look first of all at the American scene, where, for example, in terms of the sort of rational policy debate, the Democrats seem to have the edge in terms of looking after the interests of more people. On the face of it, therefore, you'd say that it's up to the Republicans really to play the emotional game, to pull on other strings, Terry. Mm-hmm.
Very much so. He makes the point that Democrats, by their nature and habits, tend to be readers and listeners and debaters, and the debaters is the problem. Republicans understand that this is not a debate. This is a conversion process. And it does go back to the old anecdote about Adlai Stevenson when he was running for president. Some woman gushed to him after a particular Democrat rally. She said, every thinking person will be voting for you. Mm. And he said, madam, that is not enough. I need a majority. Mm. Yeah. In other words, even he had a sense way back then that this was not going to be won on the basis of intellectual propositions, that there had to be a connection across a wider spectrum.
But the thing is, if you're losing, as say the Republicans are almost by definition, in terms of the policy economic debate, in other words, here are the Republicans who are giving tax breaks to the rich and so on the face of it, that's a no-brainer. You say, I vote for the party that has, but as we know, it's narrowly. Why then is the country so narrowly divided? The reason is that the Republicans have very cleverly made the election about things other than economics. They made it about identity, about, you know, moral issues.
But this underpins the key point that humans aren't utilitarians. We're not homo economicus. Mm. We're part of a tribe. We're part of a culture. We identify with people who are like us. And how we create those identities is actually a very, very important thing. Yeah. Humans are loss averse. We don't show symmetry in terms of how much we like to gain things versus how much we might want to lose things.
But I mean, really what they say is, what they do, isn't it, the Republican line is, that Democratic crowd, they're different to you. You know, they've all been to Harvard and to Yale.
And basically they're communists.
Yeah, though they've been to Harvard and Yale.
That's the line. In other words, is to create a kind of identity politics.
They have a much better sense of how to create tribalism. Sense of belonging.
And appealing to baser notions.
But all Republican advisors seem to have a better instinct for a fundamental truth of electoral politics is that people don't vote for a candidate because of the way they feel about the candidate. They vote for a candidate because of the way the candidate makes them feel about themselves. Mm-hmm. And if you listened after the previous presidential election, the first time that Obama was elected, there was a profound sense of satisfaction among the people who had elected him, not because they expected him to do anything surprising, but because of what it said about them.
Yeah, wasn't it Mandela who said, people won't remember what you said, they'll remember how you made them feel? I mean, that's really the kind of point.
I would go along with all of that, except that point where saying that they didn't have great expectations. I think in the case of Obama, they did. And in some cases, those expectations were unrealistic. And this was part of his problem. People hitched their wagons to him so much on the basis of what they saw as was very ideal, you know, and what they imagined he could do and what he could bring to the country, and that was never going to happen. But I mean, ultimately, one of the things I enjoyed about this book is that it made me go off to YouTube and look at a number of these political ads that are mentioned, the Daisy ad, the revolving door. And the one I really liked was the Clinton's one, The Place Called Hope, apart from his personal moral issues, if we can call it that, I mean, is he not the perfect candidate in terms of using that emotion to...
He also talks here, I notice, about how guilty Democrats feel about mounting dirty campaigns, Shane. They feel guilty about it.
So there's, I think, an interesting thing there. There's a political psychologist named Jonathan Haidt who's done a lot of work on morality over the last couple of years. And he studied differences between Democrats and conservatives, people who self-identify as such. And one of the things that he points to is that when you look at how people construe their world, Democrats and conservatives construe the world very, very differently. Democrats tend to evaluate propositions across a broader range of dimensions. The conservatives typically think of a narrower range, but go much deeper where those dimensions are concerned, particularly to do with morality and issues around disgust, that they seem to cluster very highly on those dimensions. And I think Democrats might find themselves, now I don't know many Democrats, so I can't judge, at least
I don't know what we're to infer from that, Shane.
No, what I was going to say was that they may find themselves confounded because the search space that they think about things in is broader and not very deep. So they might find themselves stumbling over themselves when they're trying to reason through these things.
You think it's a myth that claims that, a myth that nasty campaigns don't work?
Oh, absolutely. Mm.
And they do.
But it's one of those things where political brains, that is to say activists within political parties, always tend to revert to the mean, which is a belief, almost a moral belief in the Democrats' case, that political campaigns are evil and don't work. Mm-hmm. And they very quickly, during any decent campaign, get their wits about them and move speedily to the nastiest kind of
negative campaign.
Well,
he does make the highly important distinction between negative campaigns that are true and negative campaigns that are based on lies. And I mean, there is a distinction. I mean, that made people make somebody feel ethically better about themselves.
If you actually look at what has happened recently, this last year has been the first year where I have seen, particularly websites like Time Magazine's political website, doing a constant tracking of lies, as in, here are the 10 top lies made by the Republicans today, made by the Democrats today. I would be surprised if that doesn't come into Irish politics soon, because it has been a way of campaigning.
Oh, fact-checking is becoming
a huge thing in this. Well, it's always in the US, in journalistic terms, where you had separate people employed simply to fact-check who would, get a piece written by a journalist. So, I mean, there's much more of a history of that there. And I suppose, again, you would think that this is a mode of operating that would particularly suit the Republicans.
Not clear. How do you mean?
In terms of in terms of picking out weaknesses, I mean, what you're essentially doing, you're fact-checking, but you're fact-checking your opponent to see where they've got things wrong and what they're weak on. And then you're putting up it on a website, in a banner, headlines.
Are you saying that the Democrats are more vulnerable in the sense that they tend to lie more?
I'm picking up the points that Weston makes in the book, where he's saying, this is the sort of campaign strategy that the Republicans are far better at than the Democrats, and that the Republicans will go for the jugular every time, whereas the Democrats may be slightly more polite, or as you said earlier, might feel a little guilty, so that will
bring them back in. There's one thing when you look at the whole field here, you're saying 80% really have their mind made up. I mean, they're tribal. There's a sort of 20%, and I'm sure that's a movable figure, Shane, as to what percentage. But you always see that at the end of the campaigns. They're the people that the big players start addressing,
There is this thing in American politics that to get the nomination, you play to your base, and to get the election, you move to the centre. And I think this is, again, if I may come back to the issue of the brain for a moment, that brain-based metaphors can be kind of dangerous, because we tend to think of the brain as being a kind of a static thing, when in fact it's not. People's policy positions change, their emotions change through time, people are plastic. And you can get people to change their minds if you frame things effectively.
The organ itself alters in response.
It's altered in response to this conversation that we've had together.
In economic terms, in use of time, I was reading back some of our old documentation about 35 years ago, and in it I discovered a thing which says, if you're training politicians, tell them not to talk to the already converted. Waste of time. Tell them not to talk to the unconvertible. Waste of time.
Good. Yeah.
Floating voter good. Is the only one yeah. worth attacking. Yeah. And yeah. that, it seems to me, has turned out to be one of life and political life's great truths.
Yeah. And that...
I know there's one particular part of the book that I actually found really good, and that was the section he had on abortion, which is obviously a huge issue in the US electorally, but also has reared its head here and is going to be trundling along. And I thought he was very interesting about how the Republicans, they communicate that
they own the area.
Abortion is murder in all circumstances, end of story. He makes the point that the Democratic Party, because they haven't been able to come up with a principled stand, they haven't been able to come up with the language surrounding this, that at each election their candidates have to try and come up with their own response, and they get into more and more difficulty. But they're too timid to use the emotionally charged language back at the Republicans. And he's saying it's far deeper than a pro-choice versus pro-life argument. But because the Democrats won't bring it there,
he's
because
saying,
they're too afraid
tell
to...
The- constituents yeah. what you think. Is he right on that? That you'll do better
yeah.
if you tell them how conflicted you actually feel about it.
Yes, but the other thing he says is that people like, voters like consistency within their candidates, which was one of the great appeals that Reagan had. He was unchanging over a long period of time. So you need to establish what you think is better in black and white. You state it, but then you better be prepared to live with it for a long time.
We've been discussing The Political Brain by Drew Weston, published by Public Affairs New York. My thanks to Alison O'Connor, Terry Prone and Shane O'Mara. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.